from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for June the 2nd, the first Sunday of June. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House and on to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, what a beautiful day. The sun is shining. I just got back from a week in Springfield where the legislature is still in session, folks, even though it's supposed to wrap up at the end of May for the spring legislative session. They're still on duty. And I will tell you, I was somewhat surprised at how nice the weather was when I got back late yesterday, because I'd been looking at my weather app on my phone, because Springfield, it was like mid-80s, muggy. It would get so humid that you would have these afternoon thunderstorms, or late evening thunderstorms. But there was one day, I think it was Thursday, where I looked at the weather app, and I saw that the temperature in Chicago was 49 degrees, and it was 85 in Springfield. I don't remember a temperature differential of 36 degrees like that. But, you know, Don and Andy, it might be due to all the hot air that was coming out of the State House.
Indeed.
I mean, a lot of hot air, by the way. But we're going to talk later in the program about what the legislature has done, what they're poised to do. It looks like the State Senate is due in at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and it looks like they're poised to wrap things up for the spring legislative session. So we'll talk about what lawmakers are doing for you and to you, which is always the situation when it comes to the folks in Springfield. I regret I didn't have a chance to see much, actually almost none, of the Bruins-St. Louis game last night.
I watched a lot of it.
7-2.
And it wasn't even that close.
Yeah, well, they were up big in the first period.
Yeah, they got up 5-1, and Boston was a perfect 4-for-4 power play. And it seemed like St. Louis was just taking dumb penalty after dumb penalty after the Bruins are just lighting them up. First time Binnington got replaced, Jake Allen came in midway through the second period. It was the first time all year that that the young man had been removed from a game. First time in the playoffs that Allen had appeared.
Wow. And that was in St. Louis, too.
It was in St. Louis. It was just down the street from the from lovely Busch Stadium.
Yeah, which is kind of nice to take the attention away from what was going on at Busch Stadium.
Yes.
I 3 hour 45 minute rain delay. So obviously, I did not see any of that.
Either. Nah, that's nothing. Come on, that's child's play.
When the game only takes 3 hours and 10 minutes,
I know.
And you know they're going to do everything they can to get these games in.
Yeah, they don't want to lose those gates, and they don't want to lose the fact that it's a Cubs Cardinals series. They do whatever they can to make sure that thing gets going and it is played to the a good conclusion as far as 9 innings. They don't not yeah, as far as the score is concerned, but just as far as the game,
not the cheapened
correct
after 5.5.
Yeah, I mean you take those obviously,
right?
The White Sox had one of those a couple weeks ago against Toronto, and they certainly didn't care about that. It's a win, and you take them when you can get them. But yeah, I think that with the Cubs Cardinals rivalry, they want to make sure they play it all the way out.
Yeah, I mean, what is it with all of this rain?
It started raining in the ninth inning yesterday at Guaranteed Rate Field too. I thought, oh man, here we go again. I mean, because Memorial Day, we had almost a 3 hour rain delay, and then played for 5 minutes, and then we had another 2 hours before they decided to call and suspend the game, which we picked up the next day on Tuesday. But, I mean, Rain Delay Theater got a little out of hand. I mean, we were talking about everything from the chicken in the press box in Houston to what's on the menu to we were doing rules stuff. I mean, it tests your mettle as a broadcaster, yes. But it's never a fun thing, I would imagine, to sit through as a fan.
Well, I had kind of my own rain delay theater on Memorial Day, heading down to Springfield on the good old Amtrak. It was great. Was left Union Station on time, and we got almost to Lamont. Not very far.
Not far at all.
When the train stopped. And because of the kind of violent storms, they said that a tree had fallen on the track.
Mm.
And that they needed to have inspectors check the tracks, as well as bring out the guy with the chainsaw. And so they informed us that that would probably take a couple hours.
Oh, man.
Boy, oh, boy.
So it took almost 2 hours.
Mm. To the liquor car.
And no, I had to work.
Oh,
I mean,
man.
That was, and so then we actually, the train starts moving, and then we get into Lamont, and it stops.
Mm.
Guess what? Another tree.
These trees.
But the good news was that since the incident, the previous incident was so close in proximity.
The chainsaw was close.
Exactly. It didn't take them very long. And so, 20 minutes later, we were on our way. So the scheduled 5:15 arrival turned out to be closer, more to 8:45.
They should have just gotten the guy with the chainsaw and put him on the train.
Yeah, put him in the front of the train.
Yeah, just in case something happened again. Yeah, you know, he's right there.
Be like Mad Max.
He could be the old cow catcher.
There you
know,
there you go.
And just chop him up, get out of our way.
How come these ideas come so easy to us and not to the people that should make the decisions?
Normally, it's bureaucrats. It's bureaucratic decisions.
I'm asking the right person, aren't I?
Yeah.
And this is the last day to get that in. Dang
it. That's right. Uh-huh. It's maybe I can quick slip an amendment onto a bill today.
Yeah.
That they can. Well, yeah, but the House isn't in session, so it wouldn't fly. Going back to baseball in St. Louis, mm-hmm. So naturally in Springfield, it's kind of hair south of that dividing line. So everybody was all focused on the Blues and the Bruins. And after the Blues had won game two, you know, that was, everybody was just counting the days till, you know, they were going to take them in five games.
Mm-hmm.
And
not so much.
I proudly was wearing my Blackhawks gear.
Good for you.
Nice.
Not afraid of any of that stuff. And also, I bought a new Cubs hat to wear.
I saw. Very nice.
So, thank you. And, went into the lion's den, as it were, and came out unscathed.
Well, that's good to know.
Nice.
But, of course, I since I worked late into the evening and actually in early morning a couple of times, I wasn't really able to have to confront them for the Cubs-Cardinals series on Friday night. I haven't gotten much blowback over the fact that the Cubs have now lost 5 out of 6 and 3 straight series.
Yeah, it's,
and they're out of first place.
It's that
slump.
It's that bullpen, and the fact that they're not hitting right now.
But it was amazing when that bullpen was riding high.
Yeah, I mean, it does go in ebbs and flows. I mean, I think every team goes through that. I mean, you look at what's going on with the White Sox. They've won 5 of the last
right.
6, mm-hmm. and were in second place for a brief moment yesterday. But at the same time, they're getting tremendous starting pitching from a couple of guys, and they're getting enough offense to win some games. And it just goes in cycles. I mean, because you can have a guy that's completely and just red hot. I mean, Rizzo's hot. I mean, he's hit 13 straight games, hit his 16th home run yesterday. But, you had Javi Baez was out of the lineup last night with a bruised heel. He's day-to-day now. Hayward's been hitting again, but Chris Bryant's been hitting again. But, you have other guys in the lineup that I don't know what it is about this team right now. And if it really does miss Ben Zobrist, just his presence, I don't know. I think the Blackhawks missed Marian Hossa. It was one guy. So I don't know if that's the case in baseball either. And it's not really clear when he's going to come back. But it's frustrating because you get on a roll and then all of a sudden nothing works.
Well, and you hate to see, Yu Darvish pitch you know, pretty decent there.
Yeah, you can't waste those starts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, granted, what, it was 2-1, mm-hmm. I think, was the final in that Friday night game. But still, you get six innings out of him, one run. I mean, he had a no-no going through, I don't know, four innings. I mean, that's a quality start.
Yeah, and that game was marred by a terrible no-call at home plate by Laz Diaz, the umpire, on a great curveball, a slider, whatever it was, by Dylan Maples that was blatantly strike three. And the inning continued, and he ended up walking a guy, and then the run came in that same 10th inning. And Joe Maddon was awesome about it after the game. He didn't pull any punches, and he said the worst thing about it is my guy who pitched a really good game has to go home and feel bad about himself, and he shouldn't be feeling bad about himself.
Yeah, and talking about a young pitcher mm-hmm. and, you know, throwing in a quality game here and throws a quality pitch, doesn't get rewarded for it.
Yeah, and, you know, the old saying is you got to make the next pitch. I get that, but you know what? When you're a young player and you see that you've done your job and you've struck the guy out, it's kind of hard to get that focus back. I mean, it's a learning lesson. You don't want them to learn on the job, especially when you're trying to win games against your rival, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's, well, also, you know, what we had that incident last week, too, with the pitch that went into at Houston, the pitch that struck the four-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
Child.
That, oh, man, that was so sad. And, you know, I don't know what Major League Baseball is dragging its collective feet on. And I kind of thought that this was going to be taken care of last offseason when they were talking about extending the netting. And the netting basically in most parks only extends to the ends of the dugout toward the outfield. So the outfield side of the end of the dugout is basically where that ends. The question that was wisely asked, I can't remember who asked it, of Ricky Renteria before the game, right after that, said, hey, if you had your family coming to a game, would you seat them anywhere but behind the net? And he paused. He thought, you know, great question, because no, I would make sure that they're, you know, protected and safe behind the net. And I just don't understand why they can do it in Japan. They basically have the nets going all the way down the foul lines. Yankee Stadium has theirs extended as far as anybody's, I believe. I think the next day that should have been something.
Right.
Just get these things taken care of. I mean, and I know they're going to have to wait because they have to order things, and I know that each team kind of has their own way of doing things, and I would not be surprised if the White Sox on the next homestand have something done, because I think that they are obviously seeing what's going on there and want their fans to be protected. I wouldn't be surprised if the Cubs do something too.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a brutal wake-up call.
It's terrible. I mean, and it took that incident in Columbus many, many years ago,
right,
when that little girl died from getting hit by a puck, to put the netting all the way around. And I don't think anybody that goes to an NHL game even realizes it's there, and I don't think anybody complains about it.
You're absolutely right. You really don't. You don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't notice it at all. And it doesn't interfere with your enjoyment of
nope,
the ball.
Nope, not at all.
Well, hopefully smarter heads will prevail here, and something will get done. Well, Don Kleppen is joining us in for the traveling Dave Schwann. He's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy, of course, has the latest sports. Producer Casera's fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is here to push all of my buttons this morning. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this beautiful Sunday morning. This is the Sunday Spin. /7:22 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. Just up ahead on the show, we'll be speaking to a good friend of the program, Michael Golden. He's a former journalist. He's an author, entrepreneur. He's a man of many hats. And he's launching a kind of a new program here to put forth many of the Washington reforms that he wrote about in his book, The Golden Mean. That's coming up after the 7:30 news. And then after 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to Amanda Vinicky, who thankfully substituted for me a couple of weeks ago here on the show from WTTW Channel 11. And we'll also be speaking with NPR Illinois State House correspondent Brian Mackey. They're both down in Springfield right now, and we'll do a one-hour kind of roundtable over things that are hanging in the legislature, things that are pending in the legislature, things that got done by the legislature. So that's all up ahead on your Sunday spin. But, you know, I noted that this week marks the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And kind of interesting note is that a 90-year-old D-Day veteran, whose name is Jim Radford, he's British. He released a song for the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and it's actually doing amazingly well on the Amazon Music chart. And the profits of Jim Radford's song are going to support the British Normandy Memorial, which is to be unveiled this week. And I wanted to share just a little bit of Jim Radford singing "The Shores of Normandy."
As the years pass by, I can still recall the men I saw that day, who died upon that blood-soaked sand, where now sweet children play. And those of you who were unborn, who've lived in liberty, remember those who made it so on the shores of Normandy.
That's Jim Radford, a 90-year-old D-Day veteran, with his song, The Shores of Normandy. Well, let's go launch our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, we had last week the now-resigned special counsel, Robert Mueller, breaking his silence and offering a statement that basically did nothing to exonerate President Trump, and despite the president's repeated line of no collusion, no obstruction. Here is Robert Mueller.
The order appointing me special counsel authorized us to investigate actions that could obstruct the investigation. And we conducted that investigation, and we kept the office of the acting attorney general apprised of the progress of our work. And as set forth in the report, after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
So Mueller repeated that he was following the Department of Justice guidelines, and that you cannot indict a sitting president. But Mueller's statement has given rise to more calls from Democrats seeking to launch impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is still holding the line against that. But a new Democrat calling for impeachment is right here from Chicago, Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley, a member of the House Intelligence Committee. Here's Congressman Quigley speaking on MSNBC.
Hey, I didn't complete this investigation over 2 years and write a report to have the Attorney General misrepresented, redacted, hide the underlying materials, keep it from Congress, and basically shout down a well. It has to have some meaning. And it is clear he left it to Congress to do this.
But what action will Congress take? Interestingly, Fox News legal analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano, he listened to what Robert Mueller said in his statement, and he offered this revelation to Fox viewers.
Effectively, what Bob Mueller said is we had evidence that he committed a crime, but we couldn't charge him because he's the president of the United States. This is even stronger than the language in his report. This is also a parting shot at his soon-to-be former boss, the Attorney General, because this statement is 180 degrees from the four-page statement that Bill Barr issued at the time he first saw the report.
So Mueller's statement countered that of Attorney General Robert Barr. My former Tribune colleague and friend Jan Crawford, now on CBS, she interviewed Bob Barr about Mueller's statement that he couldn't make a conclusion on Trump's action. Here's Barr's response.
I personally felt he could have reached a decision.
In your view, he could have reached a conclusion.
Right, he could have reached a conclusion. The opinion says you cannot indict a president while he's in office, but he could have reached a decision as to whether it was criminal activity, but he had his reasons for not doing it, which he explained, and I'm not going to, you know, argue about those reasons, but when he didn't make a decision, the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and I felt it was necessary for us, as the heads of the department, to reach that decision.
So they made the decision, not Robert Mueller. That's Attorney General Bob Barr. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. 7:35 on this Sunday morning. I'm here in the Allstate Skyline studio, 18 floors up on Upper Wacker, overlooking the beautiful sunrise and sunshine on Lake Michigan, Navy Pier, and the Chicago River. Joining me here for the great view, because it's radio after all, and, you know, it's word pictures. Joining me here is my good friend Michael Golden, who author of The Golden Rule.
Unlock Congress.
Unlock Congress, I'm sorry. Yeah. I think of Golden
the
Mean.
The podcast, The Golden Mean.
Yes, right. I think, I'm sorry. And remember, I've had 8 hours sleep dealing with your friends in Springfield.
Less.
I'm still kind of here. But the reason I have Michael on is that he's launching, or relaunching, I guess. Is that the way to say it?
No, it's a new launch, okay, with some folks in Washington this week. It's a new concept call, and it's called The Fulcrum. People can look it up, thefulcrum.us, starting Thursday, and there's daily newsletters going already. But I appreciate you having me on, Rick. This is, you know, I published on La Congress almost 4.5 years ago. And I've learned a lot about the reform movement around the country, about everything from rigged districts to you know, big money influence, to the filibuster, and then to all kinds of corruption going on in local cities and counties. And there really is this quiet revolution of reformers.
I'm not sure it's so quiet
well,
anymore.
Well, it's not, right, but there's a whole bunch of people that don't know about it or don't know how to get engaged and volunteer. And what happened was, Adlai Stevenson III, our former senator here, I'm a senior fellow at his center, and about a year ago, he convened a whole number of these organizations in Washington, from Common Cause to Take Back Our Republic and Fair Vote, and all of these great groups doing different things in their own sort of territories. And he convened them, and we tried to figure out what's the best way we can help each other and connect more Americans.
And that's true, because they're kind of siloed into individual interests, like, you know, voting rights or redistricting or those kinds of things, rather than kind of as a broad-based kind of...
Right. They're separate. A great point. That's the thing. There's these separate big volunteer networks in different states and locales. And then Issue One, which was one of the groups, and Nick Penniman, who used to be a journalist, like I used to be a journalist, and he became head of this bipartisan, huge reform organization. The two of us just kind of iterated back and forth on a proposal. I got caught up back in politics in the midterm and the mayoral race, but he raised money from a number of foundations to fund this journalism entity called The Fulcrum, and there will be contributors from all over the country. There will be original reporting that they do in Washington with the small staff, and it's a way for all these different... Look, it's two things. If you don't know anything about this nerdy stuff I'm talking about, you don't have time to read my 300-page book, you can read a couple articles in the morning and say, oh, I see, they're trying to make government better here. They're trying to, it's not just reforming the process. How do we use data and information to make better decisions, right? How do we keep the legislature from going into summer sessions? What's holding these things up? And what can citizens do to try to get engaged and help. And that's what the fulcrum is all about. So I have an article coming out Thursday in it, making the case for why people from far left and far right, they will all like this. Because as you recall, Sanders and Trump couldn't be more different as people or candidates, except for one thing. They railed on the system being rigged, especially through money, before the election, not the other Trump rigging. And people responded to it. They're fed up. And then the question is, okay, it's not just that they're all bad people. It's a system. What's it with the system that makes this thing so difficult to work, the government to work in our favor?
Well, the stories are myriad about members of Congress having to devote so much of their day for call time.
Yeah, right. Oh, God.
And I mean, even, you know, even as a new member of Congress, that's automatic on virtually the day you're sworn in.
The issue one, that same group, that's their biggest issue, is money. That's why they call it issue one. And they have now, I think, 200 former members of Congress equally split between Democrats and Republicans, because the point is they all do it. And they all have to do it to get reelected, and that's how it works. There's a graphic, Rick, in my book that was leaked a few years ago from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. It basically says what a freshman, they tell a freshman, here's what you're going to do with your time during the day. You know, 2 hours for this, 1 hour for this, 1 hour for this. And says, you know, the top of the thing is 4 to 5 hours call time, not asking constituents or voters what they want.
Yeah, call time sounds so innocuous, doesn't it?
Exactly. It's for the money. And you add that up, and that's a minimum of 35 hours a week. And the high end is 80. Imagine, 80 hours as a telemarketer scooping up cash, and you're in the United States Congress.
Well, what do you think ought to be done?
Well, I'm for John Sarbanes, and actually the Democrats did pass, once they got in the majority, unanimously in their caucus in January, H.R. 1, which covers a number of things. But on the money, the biggest thing it does is does public funding for elections and leveraging, matching program for small dollars. So if Rick decides not to...
Don't use me. I don't give money. If Joe Blow
yeah,
gives.
Right. If they give, you know, there's different leverage levels. But if an example is, if you give in Sarbanes, I believe it's 9-1 if it's $50. So if you gave $50, you'd really be giving $450, and then like 6-1 for $100. Now there's rules about if you do that, you can't go raise huge money. The point, and this doesn't take all the money out of the system. What it does is it starts leveling the playing field, so people who don't know Richies, who are calling for $1,000, $2,800 per call or getting huge checks from leadership PACs, they can actually go to more voters and say, here's why you should vote for me. And once somebody puts in $5,000, they're invested in the candidate. And they feel like their, you know, small donation matters. So that's one way to do this. And there are look, New York has done this for decades, and it has improved their local city council system.
But is there any way to counter the fact that through Citizens United and the ability of these independent, quote, independent expenditure groups?
Right, the IEs,
which are often dark money groups that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, unions have that ability to do that as well. It's on both sides. But is there anything, without curbing Citizens United, which is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allowed for this, without curbing Citizens United, is there any practical effect by trying to do a small donor match program?
So that's a great question. That's actually a really good question. And the answer is, it's almost two answers. They're not mutually exclusive. So the point that you're making that's absolutely true is that no matter how much a candidate leverages up in small dollar matching of funds, if some big group can just drop a million, you know, in the last 2 weeks on the opponent, well, you're going to have a lot of trouble, even if you have leveraged funds and raised more money. So that's why I said it begins to level the playing field. But to your point, and this is a perfect point about the fulcrum, it kind of helps me bring it back. there's a ton of people in this country in a number of polls that, first of all, almost a unanimity think that the way we candidates raise money should change. And an a majority think that Citizens United was decided wrongly and should be overturned. Now, to overturn that, it's basically a constitutional amendment to allow Congress to regulate. Now, you'd think, oh, we can't do the, well, I've argued for a long time. You had 27 amendments, so it's not impossible. And right now, you're near a tipping point with people. The week after the midterm election in 2018, a poll was done by Quinlan Rosner, and people ranked number one priority of the people they voted for in that election to send people to Congress is to end the corruption in Washington. And they know that it's about the money. So the fulcrum is a way to connect up all these people across the country and get them on the same page, as opposed to what you were saying earlier, which was correct. There's a lot of siloed efforts, county efforts. There's represent.us. There's Take Back Our Republic. There's May Day. There's Lawrence Lessig, my friend's Equal Citizens. There's all these different things, and they're doing great work. How do you leverage it into a more of a national movement? And hopefully the fulcrum is going to do that. That's why I'm really excited about it. And David Myers, who worked for Congressional Quarterly for many years, a really seasoned, terrific veteran, is running the thing, and along with David Hawkins, another person from Roll Call. So they've got a great start this week. I encourage folks to go on Thursday to fulcrum.us and sign up for a free newsletter. And every day you get a minute and a half read about what's actually going on the ground and how these reformers are winning in a lot of cases.
We're speaking with Michael Golden. He's author, senior fellow, Center for American Progress. He's a man of many hats, and he's also helping to launch The Fulcrum. I'm Rick Pearson. This is The Sunday Spin. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Michael Golden. We're talking about the launch of The Fulcrum, thefulcrum.us.
You got it.
And, I mean, I want you to make the point, and I know you, but this is not a kind of, this is not a partisan endeavor.
It is not. And by the way, I'm after Center for America Progress, now I'm a senior fellow at Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy, which is nonpartisan.
I have so much trouble.
I just wanted to talk
like
my friend Adlai.
It's like a scroll board, you know, the things.
Don't embarrass me. So but I'm glad that you asked that. The article that I have running this week on the day of the launch is really about that. It's about how a couple months ago, this reformer in California, whom I don't even know, named John Palmer, he sent out a tweet about an article I'd written about all these reforms, and he recommended it highly, and it was lovely. And to my surprise, a few days later, you know, it had been retweeted over and liked over 1,000 times, and that's unusual for something that's just about, you know, good government reform stuff. But then when I started looking at who the people were that were doing this and their profiles, you had people that had MAGA, Make America Great Again, and I'm from, you know, the South, and, you know, very religious. Then you had people who were the resistance and never Trump again and facts over this or that. And I'm not making a case for either, but the point is they were at polar opposites of the political spectrum. And these days, what do those camps agree on? Virtually nothing. But in a little tweet, they could see, oh, at least this is an effort to overturn what this guy, Michael, calls a rigged system.
Well, it's again, going back to the beginning about Sanders and Trump, and it was, and you know, let's be real here, that part of the Trump's victory was the fact of people that thought government didn't work for them.
Blow it up.
And that Hillary Clinton just represented more of the same old kind of government. And, I mean, it's Mayor Buttigieg, from South Bend, Mayor Pete, is when he was here, and it's part of his stump speech. He's in California along with several potential Democratic candidates, or several announced Democratic candidates for governor, because they're having the California State Convention out there. But he's the one that says, you know, there is no normal. And if it was normal, you wouldn't have an election of Trump. And that speaks to people that there are concerns about government.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Mayor Pete, it's interesting. I was connected with the folks running their campaign. I'm not officially supporting any candidate, but they already have someone named Lucienne Rothstein, who's the head of, quote, government reform in their policy department. So at least Mayor Pete is focusing on that, and at some point I guess he'll talk more about it in the actual campaign. But these candidates, a lot of them know. They watched 4 years ago, and they could see people's displeasure. Now the question is, you know, H.R. 1 was passed unanimously by Democrats in the House and voted against by Republicans. I hate the fact that that's where some of this partisan stuff breaks down. The fact is that the congressional map favors Republicans, well, and they did a great job over 10 years winning state legislatures and drawing the lines of congressional districts, what I call rigging, but it's until the Supreme Court does something, it's legal. And so part of you asked during the break, the reform efforts going on, some of these efforts are, and what I've written about for years and spoken about, is independent districting commissions and even fair choice, fair vote representation, where you create super districts. But a step that's already going on in a lot of states is independent district commissions, where they have nonpartisan commissions to draw the lines instead of the politicians perpetuating the same districts, only easier to win. Right now, our politicians literally pick what
they
section
pick their voters.
They pick the section of the voters, the section of the map where they know they'll easily have enough voters to win.
And which creates one party rule districts, which, I mean, quite frankly, you could plug in the office holder, you know, plug in the name, it's what the party is. It doesn't matter even who the candidate is.
Yeah, here's the most powerful statistic I can think of when I talk about how these districts are rigged. A lot of people just don't know this. 85 to 90% of the districts, of the 435 House districts, you already know who's going to win before the election begins. And people going to vote, frankly, the ones where the district's not in their party's favor, they don't even need to go vote. It's great that they do, it's a civic duty, but Fair Vote, this organization, nonpartisan in Washington, they predict this thing called monopoly politics. Every 2 years, they predict early on, without even using polling, they predict basically 86, 87% of who's going to win, and they're right on the money. Which is sad.
Well, and I mean, we've talked before, and obviously we've had efforts in this state, not on the congressional map, but on the state legislative map, for example. And of course, you know, one of the big stakes in the 2018 race for governor, with a Democratic-controlled legislature in Springfield, election of a Democratic governor virtually ensures that it will be a Democrat-drawn, Democrat-leaning redistricting map following the 2020 census in Illinois.
It's great that you brought that up. So 10 years ago, when Blagojevich was governor, and it was the same Ooh. Thing, right? Well, but people, the census is taken every 10 years. So after 2010, Madigan cut up those districts. I mean, just if you're talking strategically, brilliantly, because 53-54% of people voted for Democrats in that congressional year, 2012, and yet Democrats, I think it was 12-6 in the terms of seats they owned. So both parties do this, to your point.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. This is not reserved for
Absolutely.
One party or the other. It's taking what the rules are and you know, manipulating them.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I get to talk for a second about a local reform effort. And Madeline Dubeck, who you've known for many years, she was an editor at the Herald and then the Better Government Association. She just took over Change Illinois a few months ago, and I interviewed her on my podcast. She's a highly knowledgeable person, and they're trying to keep going with the independent maps
right.
project.
They were one of the original groups behind that independent maps.
And to unrig the maps, and then they got in trouble with the state Supreme Court, but there's a way to keep going, and they're going to keep putting the pedal down to try to get a fairer map in Illinois.
Well, and I mean, just to revisit the history of that was, yes, there were efforts through voter initiative to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot for an independent, more independent kind of way to draw maps. And the court ultimately said that you really can't do voter initiatives in Illinois to change the Constitution like, say, California or other places like that. It's a very narrow window that has to affect basically the, I believe it's the size and the function of the General Assembly. And that's why the cutback amendment, for example, that reduced the size of the House by one-third and created these single-member districts that are easier to,
that's right,
to gerrymander. But that was a Pat Quinn initiative, I might add. That's why we have these single member districts. But the court said that this effort for independent redistricting did not meet that test and threw it out. And as a result, legislators are not in the, you know, people say, well, why isn't there a term limit amendment? Why isn't,
right? It's which Rauner wanted.
The map,
right?
And an
both
independent map. But obviously, lawmakers look at their own self-interest first.
And your paper just last week on the pension reform was in this similar vein, urging.
Yeah, but
because you can't do it simply by initiative.
Really isn't any constitutional change you could make that could affect pensions in the state.
That's the issue.
There's a lot of people talking about that. I understand. People ask me all the time, well, change the Constitution. You can't. You sure, go ahead, pass a constitutional amendment, it'll get thrown out in the federal court.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been there, and in the meantime, we're spending all this time litigating, and the fact is, unfortunately, we have to pay up.
Yeah, the TRIB, but they were urging with the tax thing that's going to be on next year, they were urging that at least let people have a say as to whether they want this or not, correct? The ed board?
Well, I mean, but going back to the independent redrawing stuff, I mean, there is the issue, too. You know, you have a very complicated system here where, like Iowa, it's not hard to draw congressional districts in four squares, here because of voting rights and those kinds of things. I mean, that's kind of the ultimate test. And it doesn't matter if a Republicans draw a map or a Democrats draw a map. The ultimate test is, does it comply with the Voting Rights Act?
Absolutely. And that's where it gets really tricky. Yeah,
it does. But, I remember the days where the most expensive thing every 10 years was the individual caucuses buying computers.
Right.
Now you can draw districts on a laptop.
Yeah, and better and better. It's amazing what they do. I talked to a guy during writing the book, and he created those programs and showed me how anybody could figure this out. And the data gets more and more granular with the micro-targeting.
Welcome to our data-driven world.
Can I say one thing before we go to break?
Sure.
Would that be okay?
Very briefly.
I just want to thank, this is a non sequitur, but the new mayor, Lori Lightfoot. On Friday night, as you know, we had a big gala for our community college scholarship program, which is grown by leaps and bounds. And on a Friday night, the mayor came for an hour, so did Governor Quinn, but Lori Lightfoot. former Governor Quinn, excuse me. But Lori Lightfoot came for an hour and talked to scholars and took photos with everybody on a Friday night. She had a long week, long 6 months, and I just wanted to thank her from the 1 Million Degree Scholarship Program. It was a big honor for us.
And it's a great program.
Thank you, Rick.
Michael Golden, who is helping launch
TheFulcrum.us
on Thursday. Again, nonpartisan. It'll make you think. And quite frankly, that's the whole point of
exactly.
Things. Thank you so much for joining
me. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Rick.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to your second hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining the program now are two very good friends of the program, NPR Illinois' State House correspondent Brian Mackey and WTTW Channel 11 correspondent Amanda Vinicky. And they're down in Springfield, Illinois for what I think we all hope is the wrap-up of the spring session of the Illinois General Assembly. Thank you both for joining me this morning.
Good to be on with you, Rick.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. And yes, I'm going to say everybody in this state is hopefully going to be on board with you on that one.
You know, we finished by our May 33rd deadline, no problem.
Yeah, actually, see, you stole my thunder. I was going to say, you know, instead of happy June to everybody, it's like welcome to May 33rd. And I don't know about you guys, but I thought... quite frankly, and even wrote this, that I thought the fact that they didn't get finished on time, it's a Democratic General Assembly, it's a Democratic governor, it's a Democratic governor's agenda, not necessarily whether he would have gotten everything that he wanted or not, but nevertheless, for the fact that it's one-party control and they couldn't finish on time. I thought it was an embarrassment.
You know, I certainly see that perspective. On the other hand, when you step back and think about what they have gotten done, I mean, I've been covering state government for most of the last 15 years now.
14, it's gotten to the point where years. You don't quite like to say it out loud. No. At least that's where I am. I sort of...
There are people around with longer experience, but in my time, which goes back to the Blagojevich era, I cannot remember a year when they got, you know, there were... 5, 6, depending on how you want to look at it, major things that they got done this year. And I guess if it, you know, if you had to ask the professor for an extension towards the end of the semester to get them done, it's still a very long list of accomplishments, the likes of which I have not seen from state government during my time here.
You know, Rick, I wonder, I think there... I'm a journalist, so I'm going to take the cop out here and say, I see both sides. That is that it, I think, to a degree, perhaps, was it an embarrassment intentionally? Was it something that was meant to say, hey, you know what? Big shot governor came in wanting to get everything done, bragging about getting this all cleared away right on time, budget right away. It's a bit harder than that. You're going to have to negotiate. You're going to have to do some things. Was it merely what needed to be done? Because as you noted, there is Democratic control in the governor's office, super majorities plus in both the House and the Senate. So they could have done it alone, but what ended up passing in the House anyway, and we'll see presumably the same will occur in the Illinois Senate later this afternoon, was done in a bipartisan fashion.
Yeah.
So was that what was, for whatever reason, necessary in order to get it to that point, you know, push past the deadline in order to bring Republicans on board? Certainly they could have come to the deal that they eventually did earlier, ostensibly, but whatever reason, is that some sort of, you know, we talk a lot about everybody who's voting, they're people. And some of it is just perhaps deadline pressure, procrastination. Oh, gosh, I don't want to land my entire summer in Springfield. These legislators who've been doing that for the past couple of years are ready to spend some time back home. So I think it would have been an embarrassment had it carried on, a true big embarrassment had it carried on throughout the week. But considering that things do appear to have truly wrapped up, I don't think that's a narrative that will stick with Pritzker all that long.
Well, one of the things that the Senate will be voting on will be, and I want to focus first on the capital program, the $45 billion capital program. Now, that has gone to the governor. And Illinois hasn't had a capital program since Governor Quinn launched one, but this is, you know, $45 billion. One of the things that is on the Senate's agenda today is having to vote for what the House has already done, which is the assortment of taxes and other revenue sources to fund this infrastructure repair bill, which is not only just roads and bridges and things that we've talked about before on this program, but also includes universities, schools, state facilities, state fairgrounds, things like that. It's quite a menu of taxes and fee increases.
Something for everyone. That's part of how they were able to pass it in terms of the spending portion. And then, obviously, yes, as you noted, you've got to pay for it. And, whoo, it is quite the menu. It's not just taxes and fees, although if you smoke cigarettes, you're going to be paying more. If you drive a car, period, you will be paying more. That may be very evident to folks as they fill up at the gas pump, because you'll see a doubling in the gasoline tax. I don't know if you actually are aware what goes to
That's the thing. I noticed I drive past the same gas station every day, as most people probably do, and I remember seeing the price earlier this week here in Springfield. It was $2.67. I think yesterday night it was $2.88, and that was just in the course of a week. The taxes did not change during that time. I think it's not unusual for the gas price to swing that much. I wonder how much people will really notice that on a day-by-day basis. If you don't smoke, you're not going to notice that fee. I think that
that's a dollar pack increase, right, on the current $1.98 state tax.
Right. But
to mention local taxes.
In Chicago can be considerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think there was a deliberate effort made to sort of make these less visible taxes. And some of the more apparent ones that might sort of surprise people, like I think the streaming internet tax, last I heard, was out.
That is gone.
Yes. So not going to be
that
a tax.
That would have really fired people
Netflix
up, I think.
And Pandora and things like that.
Plastic bag tax
the
was done away with.
The plastic bag tax was tossed, if you will. But that's something where people would really feel it, sort of like the soda pop tax a few years ago in Cook County there. And I think there's a real, that experience is still seared in people's minds down here.
But, and then of course, Rick, I mean, I know you're going to get to this, but also paying for a lot of that infrastructure, massive, massive, massive gambling expansion. I mean, I had characterized in my time covering state politics, which is about roughly the same as Brian's here, that adding 5 new casinos was going to be massive gambling expansion. This does that plus. You're talking 6 new casinos, additional video gaming terminals at all of those various establishments where they've popped up, turning horse racetracks into racinos, adding another horse racetrack.
Now, don't move too far ahead, because I still want to talk about the infrastructure here, okay?
But certainly
new gaming revenues are part of the support structure for funding this. But, an issue here in Chicago is now we'll have a state tax on parking at a parking garage or a parking lot of 6%, 9% for monthly users, 6% for daily users. We'll also have a tax on basically that's kind of a follow-up of a U.S. Supreme Court decision about the state sales tax going on the purchase of goods that you acquire through the internet. As you said, Amanda, there's something for everyone here, and we'll start moving into the discussion on gambling here shortly, but we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with NPR Illinois Statehouse correspondent Brian Mackey and WTTW Channel 11 correspondent Amanda Vinicky, both in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson here in Chicago. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio in downtown Chicago. And joining me in Springfield are NPR Illinois Statehouse correspondent Brian Mackey and WTTW Channel 11 correspondent Amanda Vinicky. We're talking about the not quite finished spring session of the General Assembly. The Illinois Senate due back in at 3:00 to hopefully wrap things up for and have them off to the summer back in their districts. We're talking about funding for the massive $45 billion public works program that has gone to the governor. We're talking about the program. We've talked about the funding for that. And one, as Amanda started talking about, one of the major funding components for this is a massive expansion of gambling in the state. I mean, including the potential of a Chicago casino, which would be authorized, the slot machines at O'Hare and Midway, sports gambling, which also would include gambling kiosks at your favorite major league ballpark or hockey stadium or basketball stadium like United Center, or football stadium like Soldier Field. I'm not sure that anyone really thought that a gambling package could ever get put together in this state.
No way.
Well, I mean, we've seen, Amanda and I have not seen one in our time, aside from the video gambling establishment, which, I mean, let's pause here to reflect. That video gambling has changed the face of Illinois. At least here, Springfield has one of the largest per capita number of video gambling terminals, but they are in just about every bar, restaurant. There's fill strip malls. Even there are gas stations that have put in
Lucy's, Dottie's, Julie's.
Yeah, they all have these sort of like greatest generation women's names on them. But, I mean, that's really changed the face of Illinois. And now, like you said, you're going to land a plane at O'Hare Airport. You're going to go to downtown Chicago and, well, somewhere in Chicago, maybe the south side, there will be a massive casino complex. Like you said, gambling at sports stadiums. This is, you know, we haven't even gotten to another legalized thing. I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the program. But, you know, this session now, and it's not, you know, some of this stuff was not a unanimous change, but it's really going to change significantly the face of Illinois.
Well, certainly, you know, and through the years, the city of Chicago has been up and down on whether it wanted a casino or not. And I mean, you know, I remember when there was the talk of the prospect of almost a Disney-esque type amusement park / Chicago casino. And various representatives of the ownership of casinos from Las Vegas were testifying down in Springfield. And that goes back a couple of decades ago.
Well, and this will not be, let's be clear, a city-owned casino, something else that had been tossed around. Will the Chicago own it or not? This will be a private operator. So remains to be seen who's going to actually be the one that will begin this mega complex, which will have more gaming positions than any other casino in the state. So as Brian talked about, I mean, this is a huge change for the face of Illinois, and one that, as you noted there, Rick, I mean, it has been talked about for a long time in Illinois, but nobody really ever thought was going to happen, just because it would always sort of fall apart at the last minute.
The bills would land on the Governor Quinn's desk,
yes,
and get vetoed, even after, you know, people had agonized and worked overnight for weeks and come to a deal and just got killed.
And this time it happened, and it happened pretty darn fast. I mean, there had been talk about sports betting throughout the entire session, but the addition of a Chicago casino and the five others, including in the south suburbs in Waukegan, was something that was sort of last minute. I mean, those are ideas that have been kicked around again for some time, but that final package came together in short order, and a lot of people, you know, folks that are in on these discussions are betting people and were betting against it. They said, no way, particularly given that this is something that newly elected Mayor Lori Lightfoot did want. For most of his term, Rahm Emanuel had wanted one, too. And they're like, no way does Lori Lightfoot get one of these in her lap right away to help with the city budget when Rahm Emanuel couldn't get it his whole time. I mean,
and this is more than Governor Pritzker asked for. If we remember during his budget address, he made a point to say, you know, let's do sports betting. Let's not worry about all that other gambling stuff. These Christmas tree gambling bill approaches, they always collapse
under
their
own weight. Taking the advice that it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, this is sort of like you ask for a bike for Christmas and you end up with a Mustang.
Well, just a few days ago, I was speaking to one lobbyist with interest in the gaming issue, which I think may actually be virtually every lobbyist in Springfield. but one of them told me they had no hopes that a gaming bill would pass. And in fact, this lobbyist told me, you know, I'm tired of watching Lucy put the football down and all of us go running at it and she takes it right away. I'm not going to even get into that. And sure enough, it does happen. But I think a very important point to be made is that all of that gambling was such a crucial component to paying for the infrastructure bill that I think was finally what cleared a major hurdle there. Certainly there was infighting going on between the idea of, yes, we should just do sports betting on its own, not get involved in the casino wars or those kinds of things. And in fact, it was looked upon at one time that perhaps sports betting would be a way to finally leverage casino expansion in a way, or at least calm some of the turf wars that exist in gaming, as long as everybody got a piece. Now, I think truly the fact is, having that money go to various projects in legislative districts, if you didn't vote, if you're not going to vote for gambling, then that part of the bill fails, and you're not going to have anything to write home about.
Mm-hmm. And as you noted, everybody did get a piece, was a part of it, although there are certainly some of the existing casinos that have long warned and continue to warn here about, quote, cannibalization, that people aren't going to go to their facilities if all of a sudden you can game everywhere. And we've already seen that with these video gaming establishments in every American Legion Hall restaurant, bar, and private place. How popular are these really going to be? That is obviously an open question. I'm not really a better. I don't have money to bet. But these could be sort of Disney-like complexes, more than just casinos, trying to be the one that is slated for Southern Illinois is supposed to be, its own tourism draw built into a wider establishment than that. We can expect probably something akin to that in Chicago as well. But existing casinos also, they did get, sports books and additional gaming facilities. The racetracks finally got what they wanted in terms of slot machines. So everybody sort of won in this huge equation, and that was what helped to bring it over the line also.
And they get to move off the water, right? Remember, we were so, had to get out our fainting couches at the idea that people could gamble on land in Illinois, and the riverboats used to have to take cruises. There were limited times to come on and off, and now the casinos can just sort of scuttle the boats or sell them for scrap or whatever and move on to the land if they want. But I think Amanda's point about this question about market saturation is a good one. I think that I've heard people talking sort of in whispered tones about a bubble in the video gambling thing, that maybe that industry needs to shake out. There's been some consolidation maybe ahead. And I think there is a question about whether this can really be the cash cow. This is an easy thing because it's not one of those evil tax increases we were talking about earlier. Evil from the lawmaker's perspective, but
it's a user fee. You don't have to gamble. Nobody's forcing you to, like you need to drive your car.
It's a sin tax.
But my favorite statistic about this came from the sort of nonpartisan budget forecasting arm of the state legislature. They do a report on, it's called Wagering in Illinois every year, and they looked at the number of positions, which are, the seats around a blackjack table or slot machines in existing casinos, compared to the number of video gambling terminals across the state. There are, 10 casinos in Illinois now? And the equivalent number of video gambling terminals would be an additional 24 casinos. That's already before this legislation that, we should also add that still hasn't gotten through the Senate, although there is seemingly a deal, but before this bill passed. So you have 10 real casinos, 24 sort of virtual casinos, and now we're adding on 6 more, plus the existing casinos get to expand their number of positions.
Plus the racinos.
Yeah, racetracks.
Racinos, yes, I think you're going to, most people have probably never heard that term before, and you're going to hear that term a lot now that we're going to have gaming at the racetracks.
Although it comes too late for some, like Balmoral Park, which is near where I grew up in the south suburbs. I mean, the horse racing industry has really...
Maywood Park is being demolished as we speak. So
last time I went by Balmoral, the parking lot was being used to store cars, basically. I don't know if it was for a rental car company or what it was. The fence was kind of blocked out, but it was just, the surface was just covered with cars.
We're speaking with NPR Illinois State House correspondent Brian Mackey, WTTW Channel 11 correspondent Amanda Vinicky, about what we hope will be the soon to wrap up spring session of the Illinois General Assembly. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Joining me on the phone, actually, no, joining me by the magic of the internet is Amanda Vinicky, WTTW Channel 11 correspondent, and NPR Illinois State House correspondent Brian Mackey. They're down in Springfield as we prepare to see the legislature wrap up its spring session with the Illinois Senate coming in at 3 o'clock today. We've been going through a lot of items that they did. We still have plenty to cover in the remaining moments. But first, we have a call from Mr. Steve Brown, the spokesman for Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Mr. Brown, welcome to the program.
Mr. Pearson, thank you for having me on. I told your producer I would take Ron's place today.
Okay.
I was admonished to be brief. I hoped you folks would all be like in the press room and we could have just done an in studio kind of thing. But the speaker said it was a historic, I think. Leader Durkin agreed. There are a range of things that we'll be covering over the days ahead. There was a big package of reforms on Medicaid managed care. There was a big package on improvements to the laws that will curb sexual harassment and discrimination. The gaming thing was the culmination of, what, about 20-plus years of inactivity.
Exactly. And someone actually reminded me about another issue which ultimately didn't come to fruition, which was the expansion of the restaurant taxing district for McCormick Place. And someone on Twitter said, oh, here's the story Rick Pearson wrote about it when it began 30 years ago. And I had to correct them that it was the wrong story. It was another story that I wrote 28 years ago.
There you go.
So that says, well, Mr. Brown, all good points. Thank you very much trust me, there will be a lot being digested through the General Assembly session in the coming days and weeks ahead.
I was going to say what ultimately brought about this deal is something else we haven't touched on, and that was the flurry of last-minute meetings, including, of course, with your boss, the Speaker Michael Madigan, and what got House Republicans, who'd been very initially recalcitrant versus the other caucuses on board, was adding in some of a wish list that business had been demanding for quite some time, and talking with business folks, they were remarking that, wow, and I think this is, to your point, what the House Speaker had mentioned in his closing remarks, efforts that had been tried for over the years, gambling, but also under Governor Bruce Rauner's administration, businesses got more of what they had wanted in one fell swoop right there, which is where you did see some GOP support than they had in the entirety of the 4 years under a Republican gubernatorial administration.
When you took the list and winnowed it down a little bit, it was designed to help and add, not the Rauner approach to destroy and hurt working families. So that, I think, was a key difference. And it was,
I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, I understand.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Brown. I appreciate it.
Bye, Brian.
Bye, Steve. And we heard a train there. Another thing in the Capitol project, supposedly, is relocating those 3rd Street tracks, which just happened to go by pretty close to where Speaker Madigan stays when he's in Springfield. I happen to live in that same area when I first moved here, and I think that will be a welcome change for downtown.
That'll be, yes, that'll actually be a reform for change the whole kind of network down in Springfield as part of the high speed rail construction. Let's switch over to another one of the governor's think big agenda items, one that he talked about throughout the campaign, and one that again there were a lot of doubts of whether it would come to fruition or not, and that would be the legalization of recreational adult use of marijuana. That, you know, you could almost write a book just on the progression of this legislation, particularly, you know, take it back 2 years.
Oh, yeah. When Illinois legalized marijuana for medicinal purposes and how difficult it was for legislators to past that. I mean, it was pulling teeth. It was very difficult. It was intentionally set up to be a very, very strict program, most restrictive, in fact, in the nation. And then actually another measure that after all of these major efforts in terms of the budget, gambling and such were passed, the House also took up a measure that will make permanent and essentially expand that medical marijuana program. And it passed overwhelmingly. I think six representatives voted against it.
The medical.
So just the medical part. Yeah. So just an incredible departure. It was not, of course, that easy for full-scale legalization of marijuana, but that program is one, again, that did so much more. Yes, people will be able to smoke weed, whatever you want to use.
Not
I've learned
in,
a lot
not,
of those terms.
Not in public. Not in public places.
Not in public places.
Right.
But starting January 1st, in the privacy of your own home, or if you are in, say, a hotel room that allows it. I was actually in Denver, and evidently they have set aside hotel rooms. It's kind of going back where all hotels had been smoke free. Now there are certain rooms where you can rent it, and even to purchase whatever sort of devices, I don't know. This is
or an authorized hookah parlor.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's also part of this. But
we should also talk.
That's what I'm saying. It's huge. It's more than just marijuana. There's a component, a reparations component.
Well, and that's what we should talk about, is that the people who sponsored this in Illinois, and in order to win the full support of the entire Democratic caucus, including the Black caucus, this was a very important component. They said they wanted to have this not just be about a commercial market and sort of legalization, but to sort of stretch backwards in time and look at the harm that the war on drug has done, particularly in communities of predominantly people of color. And so that's something where even the deal that was finally reached, and there were compromises made with law enforcement, and that's one of the cons. Law enforcement has concerns. Apparently right now there is no sort of legal court-accepted test for marijuana impairment. You can test someone, but it's not clear whether they...
It's not a breathalyzer type.
Yeah, you don't know if they consumed it a day ago, an hour ago, or a week ago, necessarily. And there were also concerns from the business community about whether employers would be able to have strict, sort of drug-free standards that they could maintain. And so there was a real attempt to meet all those concerns. There were still some members of the Black Caucus who were very unhappy with the end result, although some of them sort of gritted their teeth and voted for it anyway. But this is something the supporters or the backers of this plan say they really wanted it to not just be about the commercial market, but about sort of redressing these past harms.
And, there was the belief, too, and there was a lengthy caucus of the members of the Black Caucus in the House, a lengthy caucus over this legislation. And yes, there were concerns that this did not, particularly the expungement issue, was not kind of a blanket expungement, as I think many were seeking, and it's more a process that it has. The governor basically is going to have to go through things and the state police on a case-by-case basis for pardons and expungement.
Which one presumes will run to thousands and thousands and thousands of applications.
Yes, and but there was also the belief, too, that if you put this bill on the board and it has, an expungement-type provision, it would be very difficult for members of the African American community to vote against that bill.
Yeah, that's true. And they also wanted what the backers call equity in the market opportunities, right? So the typical way you see, there's a lot of rent, what economists call rent-seeking entities in Illinois, right? They come in and try and insert themselves between the government and the people and skim off the top of that. And you had all these businesses that have invested a lot of money, a lot of people with connections to the political leaders in this state who have invested in the medical marijuana industry. And it would be pretty easy for them to flip a switch and just start selling. And so there was an attempt to sort of say, well, how can we involve communities that have been most affected by past, tough on drug policies, and make sure that they are getting a piece of the economic benefits of this.
Right, because there had basically been frustration that with the medical industry, which again was very restrictive, that those businesses that were able to grow and sell cannabis were given a license to print money by virtue of the Illinois government when they won the opportunity to do so in a competitive process. But you had to be a very wealthy individual to really get in on the front of that. And now this measure actually awards sort of points in the system that decides who will receive one of these licenses from the state to get in the business. Now, if you did have a drug conviction in your past or are a relative of someone who did, that helps you versus hurts you. It's a complete reversal of really, I mean, decades of practice in the, quote, war on drugs, which Illinois politicians pointedly say they are trying to reverse.
We'll continue our discussion on the Illinois General Assembly's spring session wrap-up today with Amanda Vinicky, WTTW Channel 11 correspondent, and Brian Mackey, NPR Illinois State House correspondent. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Down in Springfield, Amanda Vinicky from WTTW Channel 11, Brian Mackey from NPR Illinois, the State House correspondent there. Just a couple of texts, and I think folks aren't quite understanding, how can you and your guests be so proud about what this legislature has done involving taxes and new laws? Folks, we're just talking about what they did. No one's endorsing any of these things in this panel. We're telling you what's going on, what's happening. So do you think we like taxes any more than anybody else? We're just telling you how it works and how it's going to affect you, okay?
We're both right rushing to jump in here. Rick, I want to say that while these are seen as successes for J.B. Pritzker, and you're going to hear talk about that, you heard Steve Brown, the Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan spokesperson, call in and talk about that. When we speak about this changing the face of Illinois, there may well be people in a couple of years cursing him for all of these changes. They may not like it, not even just the taxes, but again, we'll
pot
see.
Pot shops
everywhere, the casinos.
Expansion of abortion rights in Illinois.
Exactly. Yeah. There is certainly frustration still, particularly downstate, about something else that Pritzker sees as a huge accomplishment. It came near the start of the year and the raising statewide of the minimum wage, but I think small business owners are certainly frustrated about that and will continue to be so when it hits. He sees these as successes. This is his vision, and Illinois voters elected him overwhelmingly and also, again, Democratic super majorities to both chambers of the General Assembly that helped him to get this agenda, and it is a huge agenda, more accomplished this year than we've seen in years past. So from that standpoint, yes, a success, eye of the beholder there.
Yeah, but although there are these Democratic supermajorities, they use them. They didn't have to. They just needed a bare majority. But these were bipartisan votes on cannabis, less so, but that was still bipartisan.
Not on the minimum wage.
They were Republicans. Not on abortion or reproductive health legislation, as the Democrats call it. And barely on marijuana, but there were definitely some sort of libertarian Republicans, more libertarian-minded Republicans who supported it. But on the taxes, on the capital construction, those were significant bipartisan majorities. This is sort of from our perspective. If you have a problem with this, talk to your legislators. But these were relatively broad majorities for tax increases. I was trying to think the first tax bill that they ran yesterday. You sit there in the press box and you're kind of below this big screen that has the names of all the legislators in orange, and then a little red and green dot appears next to their name. And I cannot remember a tax increase bill that got so many green dots from both sides of the aisle. So, sure, voters may be unhappy with this, and they can express their opinions on that in next year's primary and general elections, but this was bipartisan.
So, again, I sometimes really enjoy the text line. So you just, Brian, were talking about, yes, there was bipartisan support for this, and someone promptly texts because Madigan twisted arms. You had, House Republican Leader Jim Durkin was voting on these various issues as well. And
I think Madigan had probably to do one of the least amount of arm
right. Well, right, and I think that raises another valid point, is that I think not only was there, quote, a perceived mandate from Pritzker and the governor's office with his election over Bruce Rauner.
Victory, yeah.
But also the fact that after 4 years of a largely dysfunctional state government in an ideological warfare between a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature, that there was, in a way, kind of a pent-up atmosphere among legislators, including some Republicans, to actually pass stuff that they knew was going to become law.
Right. So many of these issues had been waiting during that ideological warfare. That is, I think, another reason why so much perhaps got done here. And in terms of Republicans, why they did sign on, when you speak with Republicans, because it is so outside the norm, they say there were several reasons, including, again, those business changes that we had talked about. Also, you saw an interesting maneuver out of Democrats. Again, most of the measures that we are talking about in terms of revenue and tax increases all go to pay for infrastructure upgrades. They aren't supporting the budget itself. That there's that managed care tax fee. Other than that, most of these measures, the parking, the gambling, the gas tax, all is going to pay for public works projects. And Democrats took out all of the projects that would have been slated for districts represented by Republican representatives from that program, basically saying, you're not going to help us to pass the spending for it. We're not going to pay for the projects in your areas. So that certainly was a message. And again, Democrats had the ability to pass all of this without Republican support. They didn't want to because, of course, voters aren't going to be happy with increased taxes and increased fees. But voters also presumably wouldn't be happy and keen on sending their legislators back if everywhere else there are ribbon cuttings, nice buildings, roads without potholes, safe bridges, but not in their own districts. And that is how the political quote game is played, and I think that was one of the other things that brought about this flurry of meetings and actually a bipartisan deal.
You know, and one of the things we know from political science research, and I won't bore your listeners too much with this, but there is this bias. People who are more sort of Democrat, liberal-minded want government to do things. People who are more Republican, conservative-minded don't. And so from that standpoint, you do have that fundamental divide. If government gets a lot done, some people are going to think that's good. Some people are going to think that's bad. But I also think that the type of people who go into government, with some exceptions, you know, the more Tea Party, no caucus types, but those people are a minority in Springfield. If you get elected, you want to have accomplishments. And so there is sort of a bias among lawmakers to cut deals and get things done. And that's why you saw this come to fruition. And, you know, you talked about pent-up demand from the last 4 years. I think there's pent-up demand since the Ryan administration in the early aughts. I mean, you had Blagojevich, who was dysfunctional relationship with the legislature. Governor Quinn did not have a great relationship with the legislature. His biggest accomplishment was reducing state employee pensions, and the Supreme Court struck that down. You know, accomplishment in quotes from his perspective. And you know, now here we are, you know, Governor Rauner, we all know how that went. And so things are actually happening. I think in the building, this is viewed as, wow, this is a real turning point in government. But obviously not everyone is going to share joy in that.
That's Brian Mackey, Illinois State House correspondent for NPR Illinois. And we were also joined by Amanda Vinicky, Channel 11 correspondent, WTTW. Thank you both for joining me this morning, and we will probably be chatting with you this afternoon with the Illinois Senate. Thanks again.
Thank you, Rick.
Great to be on, Rick.